Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. We were just speaking with Richard Brown. He's the Dean of the College of Engineering at the University of Utah, and a very interesting guy, and humble, too. Our next guest is Jonathan Johnson. He is the president of Medici Ventures, which is a subsidiary of Overstock.com. Jonathan is currently on the board at Overstock and was their president and acting CEO for a number of years. Overstock was the first billion-dollar company to accept Bitcoin back in 2014, which is amazing because I don't think I knew about Bitcoin until about 2016. How about you, John?
Yeah, I mean, I had heard of it, but had not done business with them.
Well, Medici invests in firms building solutions that leverage and service blockchain technologies. Jonathan, we're pleased you could join us here on Cool Science Radio and in the studio.
Thank you, Lynn. JW, it's great to be with you. And you know, you talk about when you first heard of Bitcoin. I was at home, and my then teenage son was lolling around on the couch like only teenage boys know how to do. And he said to me, "Dad, when's Overstock going to start taking Bitcoin?"
You're
and I
kidding.
Said, "I have no idea what that is." And so he began explaining it to me. I started studying it. And by the end of the year, we'd made a decision to accept it. And we got our developers working on it. And January 9th, 2014, we became the first billion-dollar company to be accepting Bitcoin.
My question is, what cut does your son get for that finder's fee?
Well, he's still on the dole, so we'll say that's enough.
He gets health insurance,
yes,
college paid
yes,
for.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, you know, since you've been talking about Bitcoin and blockchain technologies for this many years now, it seems to me that we tune in when we hear about blockchain in the news and we kind of go, oh yeah, what is that again? And we study up on it a little bit and then it goes away and we kind of forget what it is. How do you explain at a cocktail party or a social gathering what it is?
Boy, I've ruined more cocktail parties and social gatherings trying to explain what it is. But you know, when you think of the internet, it's great at making it so that we can transfer free and frictionlessly information. When I send you an email or a website, I'm sending you a copy of something. But the internet is not good at sending the real McCoy, an actual thing. And blockchain technology is a series of ledgers, or you know, think of them books, that show what I own and what you own. And when I transfer something to you digitally, all of the ledgers on this distributed ledger get updated. So blockchain is a way for us to transfer assets. And I use that with scare quotes because assets could be anything that when I give it to you, you want the real McCoy and not a copy. So that could be a $20 bill. It could be land. It could be my vote. You don't want me to spend any of those things twice. So that's how I try and describe it. I hope it makes sense to people.
So about 5,000 years ago, we started with this fractional banking system. Sheep herder sells some sheep. He gives it to his friend, the money to hold. He says, hold on to that money. I'll be back in the spring. I got to buy some more sheep or buy some grain. Someone comes up to his friend and says, can I borrow some money so I can seed my fields? And he says, yeah, I can. So now they're using the money twice, and this whole fractional system starts. How different is it today? I mean, isn't that kind of the same a role that a bank would play today, the fractional relationship?
Absolutely. When you and I put our savings in a bank, they don't expect any of us to come take it all out at once. And so they don't have enough money to, if there was a run on the bank and everyone asked for their money, they don't have that. They do some calculation that they, you know, they think JW might come and ask for this much money at some point, but they are underfunded, and it lets them lend money out and make money, and that's how fractional reserve banking works. The thing that I like about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies and things that we're monitoring on blockchain technology, is that when I own it, it's very clear that I own it. And when I give it to you, it's very clear that I no longer own it and that it's yours. And it's It's not something I can leverage. I could give it to you as collateral and borrow, but you can't do fractional reserve banking with cryptocurrencies.
So the blockchain is now taking the responsibility of the trust institution, where the trust institution was in the middle. Blockchain is now sort of assuming that role.
Well, J.W., that's the perfect way to describe it. Because today, when you and I, or when people who don't know each other, transact, we rely on these trust intermediaries. They might be banks, they might be governments, they might be brokers. And anytime you have intermediaries in the middle, they add cost, friction, risk of fraud, and you and I aren't dealing directly with each other. And blockchain technology lets you and me work together, even though we don't know each other, because we have this technology that's really, some people call it trustless technology. I like to call it trust through technology. We can have this digital handshake where I know that if I'm selling you a stock certificate, you have the money and you're good for it, and it will digitally transfer to me. And I have the stock certificate and it will digitally transfer to you. It's kind of like when we were kids and I was selling my baseball glove for $5. I'd hold the glove, my buddy would hold the glove, I'd hold half the $5 bill, he'd hold half the $5 bill, and we'd say 1, 2, 3, and we'd let go of what we were selling and take what we were getting. That's what blockchain technology lets people do. And so I really think it's a chance to rehumanize commerce. People will be able to transact one with another without a bunch of institutions in the middle. And to me, that's exciting. You know, you talk about rehumanizing commerce. It sounds like a police song, but two, it sounds big and grand, but I think it's important that we're so distant as a community and as a society to be able to transact one with another is a really big deal.
Yeah. So I'm curious about how Overstock.com viewed the risk associated with Bitcoin back in 2014 versus how it views the risk associated 3+ years later, almost 4 years.
Yeah. So when we at Overstock first started accepting Bitcoin, we converted all of it into U.S. dollars immediately on the transaction, because we're in the business of selling products so that we can pay our rent, pay our employees, pay our suppliers, and they weren't accepting Bitcoin. Over time, we had some suppliers who said, look, pay us in Bitcoin. We had some employees who said, I take my bonus in Bitcoin, and vendors that would take Bitcoin. So we started keeping 10% of our cryptocurrency revenue in Bitcoin. And now we keep up to 50% in Bitcoin. And I'll admit, I took my 2017 bonus in Bitcoin. Wow. Now it's worth less.
There's I'm dying to know which month that was. No, well, I'm just kidding.
I took it in January, and it's not worth as much as it was in January. But I didn't take it because I'm a speculator. Yeah. I took it because I'm a believer in this. Yeah. And I think in the long term, it's the technology that underlies Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies is going to be really world-changing, and those will be worth something.
So what percentage of revenue are we looking at for Overstock?
No.
Do you receive in Bitcoin? And I forget if Overstock.com accepts other types of cryptocurrency other than Bitcoin.
So today we're up to about 50 different cryptocurrencies that we accept. And I get a weekly report, and it's Bitcoin is by far the one that's used the most. There's usually about half a dozen to a dozen others that have had some small aspect. We get about $100,000 a week in cryptocurrency revenue. So it's about 0.2%, but it's a growing percent of our revenue. So it's not much. And I will tell you this, our average order size for a typical Overstock shopper is about $200, $220 an order. For an Overstock shopper that's spending cryptocurrency, it's about $440 an order. So they spend more. They're a unique set. They're pretty loyal, in part because we were pioneers, trailblazers in the blockchain and cryptocurrency world. Those that have this, I think, are loyal to places like Overstock.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Jonathan Johnson, who's the president of Medici Ventures, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Overstock.com. Jonathan is currently on the board at Overstock and was their president and acting CEO for a number of years. One of the things that was most surprising to me in blockchain is that it's not just for financial applications. And you, your company has invested in some technology companies that have some very just fascinating applications. Let's talk about voting and what blockchain could do for voting.
Boy, I'm glad you asked about it, because last week was a big day for one of our companies in our portfolio. We've invested in a company called Votes, V-O-A-T-Z, that is trying to use the blockchain so people can vote digitally and remotely in a cryptographically secure way. Think about when we vote here in Utah. It's almost always by mail. It's kind of the big push now. And so think of all the trust institutions we rely on. We rely on our county clerk to send us the right ballot. And just last year, when there was a special election to replace Representative Chaffetz, the county clerks in the two largest counties in the closed primary system sent Republican and independent voters Republican ballots. So the trust institution failed. How do they send those ballots? They send them by U.S. mail. Well, I'm going to just say, I bet not everyone got theirs. That's a trust institution fail. You fill it out, you sign it, you put it in a confidentiality sleeve, you send it in because you want a secret ballot. Turns out most of those confidentiality sleeves were see-through. Trust institution fail again. With Votes system, I can log on with a biometric, thumbprint or an iris scan. The county clerk can see who I am and what ballot I should have. She sends me the ballot digitally. I fill it out, and then with a cryptographic key, it goes in anonymously. She knows that I'm someone that's allowed to vote, but she doesn't know who I am. She counts my vote, and then I can log back on with my key and see that my vote was actually counted as cast. Frankly, I started voting in 1984. I've never known for sure that my vote was counted as cast. Votes last week did a pilot program in the West Virginia congressional primaries in two counties there, where they had the remote overseas voters, mostly military, using this digital system. They didn't have to get it mailed or faxed and give up their privacy. And they were all able to vote digitally, and it went well. And it looks like they're going to expand it statewide for the November election there. And, you know, I think how great would it be if on election day we didn't have to go stand in line at a library or a junior high school and we could vote from work? How many times have you come in, you've seen someone wearing their I voted patch, and you go, oh, yeah, that's today. I've got to get down to the polling place. And one thing and another, you don't get there. Well, if you could just vote on your phone and know that it was secure and private, that's really something.
Exactly. There is a population of people in this world that do not use banking institutions. A couple questions. One is, why is that? And two, what can blockchain do for today and the future as we transact with our iPhones?
Great question. And when you say there's this population that don't use banking institutions, it's not because they don't want to. It's because they're not allowed. Post 9/11, we've decided that we're going to be so secure in our banking to avoid money laundering that we've put all these strict provisions in place. And so, for example, in the Caribbean, 40% of the population is unbanked. They have jobs, they have addresses, they pay their utility bills, everything you and I need to get a bank account. In South America, it's 70%. In Africa, it's 90%.
90%.
Wow.
So think about this. What do most of us use a bank for? Two things. One, to store our money. So then we get a paycheck, it just gets electronically transferred there, and we're not carrying it home in a shoebox and putting it in a safe in our closet. And two, so we have access to digital money so that when we want to spend it, if you're like me and you go to Costco on Saturday, you don't want to take a gangster wad of cash. You want to take a credit card, which is digital money. If you don't have a bank account, you don't have either of those things. With blockchain technology, you can have a digital wallet which stores either cryptocurrency or digital fiat currency, government-issued currency, and you don't need a bank. And you can transact at the grocery store, at the gas station, at the utility. And it is expensive to be poor.
Yeah.
If you don't have a bank account, think about if you have to go pay your electric bill. You've got to leave work. You've got to stand in line during open hours to pay your bill. If all of a sudden you can do that digitally, it's a big deal. So we have two portfolio companies that we've invested in that are doing just that. They're creating digital wallets. One's in the Caribbean, and it's banking the unbanked. And the other is in Argentina. And the one in Argentina, I think, is particularly interesting. A lot of people are taking their Argentinian pesos and putting into cryptocurrency, Bitcoin in particular, because even as volatile as Bitcoin is, it is a better store of value, more stable than the Argentinian peso. And the 32-year-old CEO of this company, Ripio, three times in his lifetime, he's seen the peso go to zero.
Wow.
And so for people in that country to have a place to put it in a digital currency that they could spend is a mm-hmm. big deal. And so I think cryptocurrency will see broad and widespread adoption, not first in the United States, but in countries where they have hyperinflation, where when you get paid, you either want to put it into dollars or put it into cryptocurrency or go buy bread, because bread will be more expensive tomorrow than it was today.
Yeah. Something that listening to you talk has made me think of that I haven't even wondered about before. Well, I've wondered about the implications of storing cash. And let's take a look at our neighbor, Colorado, where marijuana is legal, recreational use. Until it is legalized federally, those growers and those who participate in the industry, it's my understanding that they store a lot of cash. And that just, you know, ekes of danger and criminal activity. Is this an industry that they're buying in heavily to Bitcoin? Is that a fair question to ask?
That's a great question. And we have a lot of marijuana companies come and talk to us.
Uh-huh.
One, because it's a way for them to get quasi-banked. You know, if you're a marijuana company, you cannot have a bank account.
Yeah.
You know, that's, we talk about why people are unbanked. Part of it's all the rules we've put in place.
Right.
And so for them to be able to store money digitally is an important thing. Another interesting aspect that marijuana companies are trying to use blockchain for is the supply chain, where if you can monitor, in this case, maybe seed to pipe, the marijuana plant, you can know what it is that you're buying. And you say, well, okay, that's fine for marijuana. I'm not really interested in that. But Walmart is using blockchain to monitor its food, farm to table. And so what happens when there's a recall on lettuce? If you don't know where the bad farm was, and you don't know where the bad farm's lettuce went, you recall all the lettuce.
Wow.
But if you've got it all tracked on the blockchain and you can see the bad lettuce came from Farm A, and Farm A's lettuce only went to these stores and was actually bought by these people, you can recall particular heads of lettuce. And so it's really useful in the supply chain. And Overstock is looking at it in ways to ensure that, you know, the products we buy have true provenance. You know, if we're selling Coach bags, we want to make sure they're not Fugazi, but that they're real bags that are Coach bags. That's another way blockchain can and is being used.
Wow. This is fascinating. We're speaking with Jonathan Johnson. He's the president of Medici Ventures, a subsidiary of Overstock.com. Now, we've talked about a lot of things, been all over the place, but let's talk about the relationship between Medici Ventures and Overstock.com. So what is that relationship? And I believe I read something suggesting that maybe you were going to become independent. Talk a little bit about the relationship.
So today we're a wholly owned subsidiary of Overstock. We are housed in Overstock's campus at Peace Coliseum. We have grown to where we have about 60 developers that are enterprise-grade software developers working on blockchain projects. We are part of Overstock. At some point, I think it will make sense when we are big enough or something in overstock happens for us to be separate. There's not really a lot of synergies between the two companies other than, you know, overstock was an early adopter of e-commerce technology. We were early on that wave. We think we're earlier on this tsunami of a wave that is blockchain. And so in that sense, it's in our ethos to try new things, to be early adopters. And we think the blockchain technology will be bigger than the internet. And in 5 or 10 years, we will all be using it. We won't know how it works. You know, just like, shoot, I ran overstock for many years. I don't know anything about coding. I don't know anything about HTTP protocol. But I know how I use the internet every day, and I know how it makes my life better. And I think blockchain technology will be the same way. We will be using it, and it will just be behind all the apps that we're using.
Now, back to the Walmart example. Walmart could use a sophisticated database, but a database can be modified. A database can be lost. Is the reason they're going with blockchain because it is a permanent record that will survive management changes, survive administrative changes, administrations? Is that why?
That's spot on. This distributed ledger means it's immutable. It can't be changed. And that way, it's great for audit. You know, you'd say, well, why would Walmart change their database? Well, they might not. But here's
It could be an accident.
Here's an example that we're using blockchain for at another of our portfolio companies. They are doing blood testing in South Africa. So the South Africans are frequently tested for viral blood diseases and TB. And it's a very transient population, and they speak a lot of languages. And when they see doctors, the doctors don't know what their past history was. Well, putting that on blockchain technology and allowing the patient to biometrically log in and say, here's my history of blood testing, here's my history of medication. Now the doctor in the new shanty town that the person has moved to can see, oh, I see the history and make a better prescription. And you say, well, maybe that sounds an awful lot like Canada and it's single payer system. But in South Africa, new rulers would come in, new people would come in, and they would erase the database. Now you've got a database that can't be erased. It's fantastic.
And if the Gates Foundation is going to put their money into something like that, they want to make sure that that record is solid.
Yes, and that's who's doing it. It's the Gates Foundation and Factum.
Jonathan Johnson is our guest. He's the president of Medici Ventures, a subsidiary of Overstock.com. We're delighted that you could join us here in the studios. Thank you.
So much fun. Thank you for having me.
Great conversation.
We'd love to have you back.
Very enlightening.
Anytime I can be on something that's called cool and cool science, sign me up.
All right. Thank you. And we'll be back after these words.
Join the Utah Symphony for the final program of the season with performances of Korngold's Violin Concerto featuring Concertmaster Madeleine Adkins and a newly commissioned work by acclaimed French composer Tristan Murail. Season finale Rachmaninoff Symphony No. 2, May 25th and 26th at Abravanel Hall. For tickets starting at $21, visit utahsymphony.org. Utah Symphony is a nonprofit organization supporting KPCW.
Hi, this is Tom Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We proudly support KPCW and many other local nonprofits. We have been supporting the local community and providing real estate services since 1976. All current and active listings can be found on our website at bhhsutah.com.